So our last speaker is Nick Patterson. We have the great pleasure and honor to welcome him, and he's going to talk about the spread of Indo-European across Eurasia.
Very good. I'm very, very happy to be here, or be here virtually. I was very much hoping to be in Paris this summer, but COVID did not cooperate. So you have to live with me remotely. I'm going to try and share my screen now, and let's hope that works. Good. Can people see that? Okay, very good. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the spread of the largest family of human languages. The problem of how this happened has been around for more than 200 years. But in the last 10 years, we've made enormous progress. Perhaps chiefly because ancient DNA has come along and is speaking to the problem. So in this talk, I'm going to briefly talk about Indo-European linguistics. I'm going to then spend most of the talk talking about how Indo-Europeans spread. There's a funny quacking sound on the line, which I suspect is at your end. Can you help that? Oh, if you don't hear that sound, that's great. That's fine. I will live with it. Good. So I'm going to tell you what we know. That's the bulk of this talk. And then I'm going to tell you what we don't know, which is there's still plenty of that. And I want to make it clear that this talk is a rather personal view. I'm giving you what I hope is a well-informed view of one guy, that's me. But there are many aspects of what I'm going to tell you which other experts would disagree about. And some of what I say to you will certainly prove to be wrong in the future. I've tried to make it clear what I'm really pretty sure about, what's highly likely, and what's we really are mostly guessing. Let's move on. And the first thing I want to say is that this is a really gigantic project. I'm sure that just in the last decade, more than 1,000 people have contributed to papers on this problem. Many of them have been collaborators of mine. But I wanted to single out Eski Willerslev's lab. Eski has not collaborated with me so far, but a great deal of what we've discovered has come from discoveries by his lab. This is a multidisciplinary effort. We have archaeology. I've listed some of my collaborators there. And I especially want to single out David Anthony, who is an expert on the archaeology of the Pontic Caspian steppe, and has taught me much of what I know about archaeology. There are linguists, Don Ringe and Johanna Nichols have been very helpful to me. And I'm a geneticist, like most of you, and I've listed some of my main collaborators here. I work with David Reich and his lab, and many, many members of his lab have contributed to this project. But I especially wanted to single out my friends Joseph and Vagish, each of which have contributed importantly to the Indo-European problem. So let's begin. After all, Indo-European is defined linguistically. So Here is a big tree of Indo-European, constructed entirely from linguistic information. I'm not going to walk you through the whole tree, but I want to tell you some main features. So at the root of the tree here, we have Proto-Indo-European, which is a reconstructed language. Most experts, including me, believe it was a real language spoken somewhere, but we don't actually know where it is. And that's one of the things we very much like to find out is, what is the Indo-European homeland? Then the first split off is Hittite, which is an ancient language spoken around 2000 BC in Anatolia. The next split is Tocharian, amazingly, a language spoken in Western China around 2000 or 2500 years ago. And then we have a reconstructed language, which I call late Proto-Indo-European, LPIE. And this is the ancestral language of all modern Indo-European languages. If your mother tongue is Indo-European language, then this LPIE is an ancestral language to what you are speaking. Let's just mention a few features of this tree. We have a node here which links the Celtic languages and Italic languages like Latin. Down here we have Germanic and a complex set of languages, old and new. And over here we have a most interesting clade, Indo-Iranian and Balto-Slavic. Just for geography, it seems extremely surprising that there would be a link of languages spoken in South Asia and languages spoken in the Baltic. But linguists believe that to be true for a long time, and we very much like to explain that. So here's a summary of some of the really important linguistic splits I'm talking about. So where is the homeland of PIE? I mentioned that. We have Hittite splits off. Where and how did that happen? Tocharian splits off. And late Proto-Indo-European divides. We have Germanic, Armenian, Greek, Italo-Celtic. We still do not understand the details here. They're very obscure to me. We have clade Balto-Indo-Iranian, what's going on there? And then Indo-Iranian and Balto-Slavic split. How did that happen? So these are some of the things we'd like to understand and explain. So just to make it very clear, I'm interested in the ancient spread of Indo-European. Obviously, Indo-European is spoken throughout the Americas. There are many English and French speakers in Africa, but this is caused by recent colonialism. And I'm interested in the ancient spread of this language group. And it's really remarkable that by 500 BC, we have Indo-European being spoken in Western China, North India, and the Atlantic coast of Europe. How did that happen? So, an extraordinary fact is that almost all Indo-Europeans today have ancestry which is descended from the Russian steppe around 3000 BC. There's a very well-known pastoralist culture on the steppe, the well-known archaeologist called Ian Mayer. And with high confidence, we identify the late Proto-Indo-Europeans with the Ian Mayer. The Ian Mayer herded animals. And my colleague and friend David Anthony wrote a book 15 years ago, Horse, Wheel, and Language, arguing that Ian Mayer was the origin of Indo-European. David's book contains no genetics at all. And it's really very striking to me. He writes this book on archaeology and linguistic grounds. And then geneticists like me come along, and we discover that people who are speaking languages descended from Ian Mayer language also have genetics. There are still people holding out that they don't believe that the Ian Mayer were LPIE. But I joke with my friend David that if he was wrong about that, he was awfully lucky that the genetics matched exactly what he said. So I'm really very confident that David got it right and the Ian Mayer are the LPI. So let's talk about these people. They flourished from 3,300 BC, very roughly, for about another 800 years. They were nomadic pastoralists with wheeled vehicles. They're not likely to be the very first people who ever used wheeled vehicles. There are some groups in Eastern Europe who had light carts, maybe a little earlier. But these may be the first people in the world for whom wheeled vehicles were really a major part of their lifestyle. If you they had large wagons, ox drawn, and if you can think about living on the steppe, the grassland is thin. You graze your animals for a few weeks; they eat up all the grass. Then you have to move on, and having a wagon where you can put all your stuff, put the young children in the back, and so on, a huge advantage. The Yamna wagons were quite substantial. My archaeologist friends think maybe you could put 2 tons of stuff in one of these wagons. That's impressive. Wooden wheels and at most copper tools to make the wagons. We believe that the Ian Mayer were horse riders. Riding horses is an enormous advantage if you're looking after animals. And it would also, of course, be a huge asset in warfare. We can construct wheel words for late Proto-Indo-European. And that, to some extent, fixes the time that this culture can originate. It can't be too early because nobody was using wheels. And it can't be too late because we're seeing a spread of wheel vehicle culture all over Eurasia. The Ian Mayer were warlike people. And this fits with what we know about Indo-European culture. In Homer and in the Indian Vedas, we have a common phrase, which is undying fame. And you earn undying fame by being good at killing your enemies. Very violent. These people had characteristic burial mounds. These are large earth mounds with a ritual wooden structure underneath. A lot of work to build that. You only got a Kurgan burial if you were elite, that's for sure. But the steppe is pretty flat. And lucky for us, to this day, you can easily identify Yamnaya Kurgans. You stand on the steppe and these earth mounds are visible. Many, many of them have been excavated, but there are still hundreds of Kurgans which have been completely unexamined. So I expect over the years more valuable archaeological data will be found. So it's very important to try and understand the genetic origins of the Yamnaya and the early splits of Turkerian and particularly Hittite. So the first discovery that's relevant here is that these people formed genetically more than 1,000 years before they formed culture. We have, which many of you will know, we have techniques for trying to determine admixture dates. And for these people, we get a very, very nice, rather clear date. And we can determine something about who's mixing in here. There's movement from the Caucasus or the Piedmont, which is the foothill area between the Caucasus Mountains and the steppe proper, into the Ukraine, Don Dnieper area. And this movement occurs around 4,200 BC. And a culture, a well-known to archaeologists, called Sredny Stogforms. And Sredny Stog is variably admixed between these Caucasus genetics and peoples who were in the Ukraine much earlier, perhaps as early as the 6th millennium BC. Yamnaya belong to this Sredny Stog group genetically with a rather high level of Caucasus genetics. And if I were a geneticist, pure geneticist, I might call Yamnaya late Sredny Stog. They look very, very like the Sredny Stog samples we have. The dates are a bit older, and culturally they're very different because they have this mobile pastoralism. We definitely need more detail here. I think the key events are occurring in the late 5th millennium BC. And that's a really long time ago, and we don't really have enough ancient samples from the period to say exactly what's going on. So here's just a crude sketch to fix on what I just said. We have a group on the Caucasus, somewhere up here, not very clear exactly where. And some of these guys move up into the Ukraine. We can date that about 4200 BC. That's 1,000 years before the Yamnaya form. And then in my view, later on, these people in the Caucasus, some of their descendants move south and into what's now modern Turkey, and eventually into Anatolia, and form the Hittites. But we really don't know when this happened. There's a 2,000 year gap between this movement onto the Ukraine and the Hittite Empire in Anatolia. So this places Proto-Indo-European sort of in this Caucasus region, but not very precisely. And I just think we have insufficient data. So they formed culturally at the end there, about 3200 BC. And very quickly, we get a massive expansion. They move east, on the Volga River, Chelyabinsk in eastern Russia, into Siberia in the Altai Mountains, where there's a culture called Afanasyevo. The Afanasyevo are genetically 100% Yamna. There's essentially no difference genetically between the Yamna on the Volga and the Yamna more than 1,000 kilometers east in Siberia. They also move west into Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, Moldova. And then later on, they become the main genetic component of a well-known culture in Europe called Corded Ware, and a bit later, a second culture called Belbikas. I'm going to say a little bit more about particularly the Belbikas. The Belbika culture probably or possibly originates in Iberia, but little or no genetic connection with Belbikas in Northern Europe. One thing we found out from ancient DNA is that when you get a culture shift, sometimes it's new people coming in, and sometimes it's the old people who were there before learning a new culture from somewhere else. And it's very, very difficult to tell archaeologically which of those things occurred. You really need genetics to see if there's a genetic shift. So here's the sketch again. We have this movement east into the Altai with the Afanasyevo, movement west. And the archaeologists were astonished at this. This really is an event almost unique in human history, I think, where you get an enormous expansion geographically at an incredible speed. But we definitely got it right, because we recently discovered a pair of relatives, their cousins. One of them is a Yamna in Hungary, and the other cousin is an Afanasyevo in the Altai. So I believe this whole expansion east and west probably happened in 150 years max, and maybe much faster. So let's say a little bit about what happens in Europe after the Yamna arrive. So they mix in with the farmers who are already there, forming Corded Ware. Some of those mixing people move south or southwest into the Balkans, and some move west into Germany. And then a little later, we get a further movement west with the Belbika culture, moving across Europe, and particularly moving into Britain. And people also moved down into Iberia. So by 2000 BC, this Yamnaya steppe ancestry is spread throughout Europe. So Corded Ware arises, Germany, Hungary, Scandinavia. And for many years, there's been a big argument among archaeologists about whether Corded Ware was a steppe culture. There are aspects of Corded Ware archaeology which look like steppe, and there are aspects that don't. And this debate has gone on for more than 50 years. But I think it's been settled by the genetics. We have the Corded Ware at least 70% steppe, and some early samples are 90%. And so it's sort of obvious that the steppe aspects of the culture come in from the steppe people. There's an interesting complexity, though, which I think is worth mentioning, which is, it's been understood for quite a long time that the Germanic languages have a number of words that are obviously not Indo-European, and they're typically words relevant to farming. So what's going on? Well, there's a very nice story. The steppe pastoralists come in, they mix with the local farmers, and they take up farming, which is because the area they're in is more suitable for farming than pastoralism. And of course, the farmers have technical words for all their crops and tools and so on. And what words are the new people going to use? Well, unsurprisingly, they use words from the old language. That fits very well. So here's here are a picture of some corded ware pots, and you can see these lines, striations, running around the pots. You make these by taking a wet clay before you fire it, and wrapping a cord tightly around the clay, which makes these characteristic patterns, and then you fire the pot. So that's where the corded, that's why it's called corded ware. And here is a bell beaker artifact. There's a copper sword here. And you have these very characteristic flared pots or mugs. And what we see in many bell beaker tombs is a male has been buried with just one pot. The natural explanation is that there was some sort of initiation ritual. And as part of that ritual, you'd be given a very specific pot that would be yours and important to you. And then when you died, they buried the pot with you. These pots look completely different from corded ware. And even an amateur archaeologist like me can spot the bell beaker pots pretty easy. So, and here's a map of, these are bell beaker archaeological sites, and they must have been much more widespread even than this. Not all bell beaker communities would have been discovered and excavated. You can see that they must have been the maritime people. These sites on the southwest coast of Sicily make that pretty clear. And notice that they got to Britain, 2400 BC, no trouble crossing the channel. So they're dispersed across at least a very large part of Europe. So bell beakers have just about 50% steppe ancestry, a bit less than the corded ware. And I believe that they're genetically a mix of corded ware and some earlier farmers. So corded ware arrive, and the earlier farmers also survive somewhere. And then mix in a couple of hundred years later. This seems like a common pattern in deep history of humanity. What happens is that new people arrive, the old genetics almost disappears, but a little later on, the genetics reemerges. So what must be happening is that the older people are being displaced somewhere. We're not finding their archaeological sites very easily, but they've got to be around because their descendants come back and bring some of their genetics anyway back into the population. Bell beakers are the first people to bring step ancestry to Britain. And a question we'd like to know, and probably never will, is what language did Beakers speak? Very hard to tell. It's not obvious that they left linguistic successors, and of course they were not a literate culture. My own guess, and it's just a guess, is they spoke Indo-European of a language family that's now extinct. So, next major event. We've already talked about a massive movement from east to west, bringing step genetics into Europe. About 2400 BC, we get a reverse movement from west to east, and people are moving from Eastern Europe back onto the steppe. This is a very important event. And Russian archaeologists for 20, 30 years have been saying that these groups show very clear connections with Indo-Iranian. In fact, we have a tomb that from a culture I'm going to mention in a little while, Sintashta, where there's a ritual horse burial corresponding very precisely to the description in the Indian Vedas of a horse sacrifice. So the archaeologists have been saying these people have Indo-Iranian connections. Then, this is really relatively new, Uralic experts have discovered that a large number of loanwords from Proto-Indo-Iranian have moved into Uralic, which is a language spoken, big language family in northern Russia. And remarkably, they're able to date the loanwords because the Uralic languages have split up around this period. So linguists are saying, yeah, a lot of loanwords from Proto-Indo-Iranian into Uralic, around 2000 BC or a little earlier. And then I wrote a paper with my colleague, Vagish, showing that these Russian products of the back migration are the likely source of Indo-European in South Asia. So we really have these three different strands of evidence for an Indo-Iranian connection on steppe around 2400 BC. So here's a map. We've got corded ware out here. People coming in from the corded ware culture. And there's a culture called Facinovo about 2500 BC. And then these people carry on moving eastwards. So you get Facinovo here, and then later on you get Sintashta and this culture Andronovo. Sintashta are a very interesting culture. They're the first people in the world to use chariots. They invented the war chariot. That turns out to be very important in later Indo-European culture. In particular, chariots are important to the people of the Vedas. They're driven by heroes and gods. And they were the super weapon of the second millennium BC. What we think happened is that Proto-Balto-Indo-Iranian is being spoken by Facinovo. And the Baltic Indo-Iranian split is occurring with this movement here. In other words, these people, the Facinovo, eventually become the linguistic ancestors of the Baltic people. And Sintashta and Andronovo are ancestors of the Indo-Iranians. And then just a little bit later, we don't exactly know when, between 1900 and 1500 BC, we have a movement of Indo-European people into North India, in the Punjab. The earliest Vedas are dated by linguistic experts to be about 1500 BC, but very likely Indo-Europeans arrived there a little earlier. So we have Indo-Europeans in Western Europe. The two main language groups are Celtic and Italic. How did these two groups form and split up? That's very unclear. And all I can tell you here is this is not much better than an informed guess. I think maybe the ancestral group was in France around 1200 BC. There's movement into Italy, which eventually leads to the Italic language group, Latin and some other languages. There's movement into Britain, probably gradually, which leads to what we call Insular Celtic. And there's movement into Iberia, which I think happened through the Atlantic coast. There's a language called Celt-Iberian. And Gaulish develops in what is now France. All these are Celtic languages, except the Italic. And it's very unclear how Celtic reaches Ireland and Scotland. I just don't know at the moment. So here's my little sketch. You've got a proto-Celtic group here. Some of these guys move into Italy. Some of them move across the channel into Britain. And I think there's a maritime movement into Spain. The reason we think that this is likely to be by sea is that in Roman times, we understand that there are Celtic speakers in Western Iberia, but there's no evidence at all for Celtic being spoken in Eastern Iberia. And so that's very hard to understand if they came into Spain by a land route. So I've told you a lot about what I know or guess. Here are some unresolved issues. How did Hittites get to Anatolia? Don't really know. I've hardly mentioned Greeks. How did Greeks reach Greece? Where from? I believe there's a relationship between Tartarian speakers in Western China and the Afanasiego. There's some recent progress on this, but it's still very obscure. Were Bronze Age Britons proto-Celtic? Well, probably, but I'm not sure. I've not mentioned Armenian, very interesting language group. I've not mentioned Albanian, which is something of an outlier. And step ancestry, we know, reaches Iberia about 2400 BC. What are the linguistic implications? And I'm guessing that these early migrants in Iberia did not speak Indo-European. So just to sum up, this is a huge, massive effort with three very different disciplines: archaeology, linguistics, and genetics. Genetics is using both modern and ancient DNA. There is nobody in the world who is an adequate expert on all three of these disciplines. And there's very few people, and I'm not one of them, who's an adequate expert on two of the three. So our problem is to synthesize all the information that's available. And we absolutely need big multidisciplinary collaborations. Thank you very much. I've not been able to tell you why I think what I think. You know, I've had to cover 3,000 years of history in 45 minutes. But this is a huge ongoing project. It's been a lot of fun, and there's a lot more to find. Thank you very much, and I'd be very happy to take questions if there are any.
Thank you very much, Nick.